Well, as you're getting a seat, Scott Robinson asked me to do something, and he didn't put a whole lot of parameters on it. So thankfully, he was called away. He's not here today. And so, so as a result, I feel very good about that. Artificial intelligence, I didn't know much about it before I looked into this. What I thought it was, you know, you have these guys at school that pontificate and act like they know a lot, but they only know this much, and they're nothing down there, and it's artificial. And I figured something bad, you know, you don't have enough intelligence and don't know you don't have enough. It's got to be something bad. Well, there's some bad aspects to this, but there's also some very good aspects to it as well. I think if we look first at natural intelligence, I think pretty much where things got bad is with the fall. You know, when you're in the Garden of Eden, and all you got to do is tend to a little bit of flowers and things like that, and the food is given to you, and that ain't kind of problem. You haven't got any work else you have to do. Yeah, that's paradise, you know. But what happens, you know, after the fall? Well, after the fall, gosh, you're not thinking as well as you used to. You're not in as good a shape with your Heavenly Father as you were before. You know, He kicked you out of the garden. You're out of there. You're out there with all the weeds and everything else. Well, you're going to have to start doing something to make ends meet, you know. And over time, as I see it, that's what man's been doing, you know. He's been doing something to this hostile environment we live in. Try to make something better, make something good. A lot of things he made were bad, no question about it. But nonetheless, I think that's really what's happened. And I think that we'll first talk about machine intelligence. You know, when you're out there in the garden doing your own thing with your hands, you know, that's not very efficient, not very easy. So what do we get? Well, you get some tools made. And you can figure that out and figure, hey, this is going to make things easier and magnify my efforts, you know. And in addition, well, there's other beasts here and things like that. They shouldn't get off scot-free. Grab it around their neck and make them pull, you know. Let's make that happen. You know, in addition, the forces of nature, trying to corral those rather than have them just be all negative like we're going to be facing. I think corral it, that'd be great. You know, so again, I think that that's part of the tools. The other part is basically your own mind and thinking how things do. And so I just want to give you just a brief example of where we've gone in terms of mathematics and things like that. Well, this is Pascal, and one of the things he did, he was a French physiologist, but what he did was basically in 1642 he made this machine that could do plus and minuses. You didn't have to do it all yourself, you know, you could do it that way. Well, this guy actually went ahead of him. Leibniz was a German physiologist, and he developed this thing where you get addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. I mean, all those things were there, and this was 1671 that they did that. But it made things a lot easier for people dealing with numbers all the time, certainly. How about this guy here? I don't know how you pronounce his name, but look, the year was 1622, and he developed the slide rule. Now, why in the world, you know, these guys working up there with a slide rule already available? You ever try to use a slide rule? I had to do it in physics one year in school, and it was horrible. Horrible thing. And you got these guys in aeronautical engineering. They got one tied to their belt, and it goes all the way down to their knee. You know, it's that long. And they think, well, man, I'm great. You know, look at that, you little bitty thing you got. Well, but in any event, slide rules, no. I hated slide rules. That was no good at all. This is what I've loved, you know. The pocket thing, you know, you do those kind of things, and I know that teachers in school don't want people not learning their addition and subtraction. Yeah, I understand, that's important to learn, but yeah, I don't use it, you know, just a little pocket thing, that's all you have to do, really. Now, we've got some intelligence, we've got to have some power. And James Watt was the one who put a refined steam engine together. And so basically, we've got now with machine intelligence, we've got a lot of things to think about. We've got some things we can use. We've got some power we can use. And I think that's good. So now we're going to talk about artificial intelligence and what this is about. And this is very simple, really, in one sense. This is the guy that basically was the guy that brought it about. Turing was a guy that was very smart. He was the father of the daytime computers that we use all the time now. And he had imagined in his mind how this computer could work. He could make it all work. But the problem is he didn't have any money. You know, so it was all basically something that he thought, well, this would work, but I can't do anything about it. Nobody's going to pay me to do it, and I can't get it myself. So what happens? Well, what happens was World War II. And when World War II occurred, the Nazis, they were sending these coded messages all over the place, and it was felt like, good, wouldn't that be great if we could intercept some of those things and do something about them, either knock them out or change them or at least get the information? And he said, yeah, I think that'd be a good idea, and he actually went to school learning about codes and things like that, and he developed his machine, and that's his machine. The Bombay machine. The Bombay machine was not a thing you carry around, you know, but nonetheless, there was something like 112 Enigma scramblers that were all mixed together. And he, when those things came through that, you know, he did a wonderful job in terms of getting the information. And I think that Winston Churchill said, that's the single most important thing that happened in World War II in terms of beating the Nazis. It was getting all their information and either changing it around so it was messed up, or cutting it, or just devouring it, whatever. So in any event, that was good. Obviously, this was a good picture of what intelligence is about in terms of using something that's artificial. This is the guy that gave the nomer to this. This is back in 1956 to department conference at Dartmouth, and I want to read this to you because this is really what artificial intelligence is. Artificial intelligence is a branch of computer science. That's what it is. It's part of computer science. Part of computer science that attempts to understand the essence of intelligence and produce a new intelligent machine that responds in a manner similar to human intelligence. That's all you're trying to do. You're trying to get something that works like a human being, but has more capacity and maybe more help to you in certain situations, at least. So now we've got to figure out how these things are going to get together. And these things that I'm going to mention to you about how these things were tried out, they're not in chronological order at all. They're in somewhat in order of simplicity, I think, but not chronological. So this here, obviously, is something that is relatively new. You know, all these things, you ever used any of these things? It's amazing to me. You talk to Alexa and ask her this or ask her that, or where's this, can you give me this song I'd like to hear right now, and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's not easy. Look at the number of engineers they got to keep going to keep this thing running and make it available to somebody's just speech. 3,000 engineers doing that just so you can have your music that you want to have. So again, that's pretty neat, but these things are all part of that. I mean, having some machine that can understand what you're saying and then do what you want asking it to do, that's a huge jump for certain. Now, Jeopardy, that's been a big thing. So Jeopardy, I used to do that all the time, you know, but what happens now is half the time I got the answer, but it's 4 minutes, 4 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes later, you know, and if they had a Jeopardy for old people, you know, and you could push the button and you got as long as you want, you know, to get the thing. That'd be fantastic. I'd join in that right away. Well, this was basically a thing they put together to see how good are these people at Jeopardy versus the computer. And we got here Ken Jennings. Ken Jennings was the one that won the most money, 74 of these programs. He had $3.5 million. Brad Rutter, he got more money than anybody. He was in when you only could have five meetings, that's it, and you were out for the rest of your life after the five. But they bring back these things, you know, to have a massive sort of thing, and he won all of those. In fact, he never lost a Jeopardy in the whole time. He had $4.5 million, and we got Watson. We'll talk about Watson, but Jeopardy was on two days back in 2011. It's been quite a while ago. So anyhow, who was Watson? Do you have any idea who Watson was? It wasn't the Watson Clinic, but how about, do you know a doctor named Watson?
Yeah.
Sherlock
who?
Holmes.
That's Sherlock Holmes, absolutely right. What was the lady who kept his apartment? You're not a connoisseur, no. Mrs. Hudson. How about golfers? Any Watson golfers?
Tom
Watson. How about another one?
Bubba,
yeah. How about a scientist?
Watson the Crick.
There you go. Gosh, you guys are good. I thought this would take all day. So in any event, we've got Jeopardy and Watson, and Watson's an IBM computer, of course, and Watson's named after Thomas Watson, who was the first CEO, you know, of IBM. So what are they doing with this? They got this computer that's got massive amounts of storage space. It's also very, very, very fast. You know, but even the massive storage space, they can't get all they want. So they start bringing in stuff. Bringing it in and paying for it and all this kind of stuff, bringing it in. They said they could get 500 gigabytes in a second. 500 gigabytes of information in a second. I can't believe that. I just can't believe it, but that's what they say they could do. That's a million medium-sized books. That's what that is. So they're loading this all into Watson. You know, so these poor guys out there, what kind of chance they have? I mean, gosh, nobody's got a brain like that that can do those kinds of things. And as a result, yeah, that's true, Watson won. The other two didn't do too badly, but Watson was the one that won the money. And this is how the money turned out. So the guys don't feel too bad about them. They got $300,000 and $200,000 for 2 days' work, actually 2 hours' work. I mean, that's not too bad. What about Watson? They got brought $1 million into the company, didn't they? Yes. But the company spent billions of dollars putting him together. You know, that was not an easy thing to do. And when they got done with the whole thing, they broke it down and said, we're not doing this anymore. We're not going to be professional Jeopardy players, you know. And they got something else, you know, some of the project. But nonetheless, it did show that, yes, you get a fast computer, huge amounts of data, and you got some smart people here are toned to that game. No, they're not going to beat the computer. I mean, the computer's better in that kind of a circumstance. Now, this is the board games. And the first board game is checkers. And I haven't played checkers in a long, long time, but I think that this guy, Arthur Samuel, was also at IBM. You know, he started out wanting to make an artificial brain. He thought he could make an artificial machine that was just like the human brain, and that went torpedoed down pretty quick. But he did say, well, how about let's see if we can make a machine that can beat the best checker players. And again, hard for me to understand. I don't understand it. But they say the number of potential moves in a checkers game is 5 times 10 to the 20th. 10 to the 20th. Yeah, and that's beyond my ability to understand, but nonetheless, that's what he says. Well, he worked on this and worked on this well, but it didn't really come to fruition. And so, and he got older, and so this other guy took care of it. Yeah. This guy is in Canada, you know, and he said pretty much he traced all the stuff Samuel did and started all over again. And at the University of Alberta, he developed this thing he called Chinook. And Chinook was going to take on then the best checker player around. Well, this happened to be the best checker player. Anybody know who that is? Well, this guy is Marion Tinsley. And Marion Tinsley is he's an unusual guy. I don't know him personally, obviously, but he's an unusual guy. He didn't have any family. He was kind of a semi-pastor at a church, but he didn't do that very often. When he went to school, 8 hours a day he played checkers is what he did. Now, he went to Ohio State, and I'm not saying they got a checkers degree. They do not have a checkers degree or basket weaving or any of that stuff, you know. He got a mathematic degree, a bachelor of science, master's, and PhD. He got all those together, got his checkers together, and went to FSU. That's where he went. Look at this down here. It says this. You know, these guys look at these things when they're doing the checkers. Yeah, I'll move this one, move that one. They do it pretty fast. Then it gets down to about 10 pieces or so, and it gets very serious at that time. What they say is if there's 10 pieces or less on their board, there's 39 trillion possible things. I would say maybe 100,000 at most, 39 trillion. So that means this is very complicated. You know, and how can a human being do anything like that? How can even a machine do something like that? Well, what we got here also, this is kind of interesting. That's the ideal checkerboard for a championship game. None of this red, black stuff. No, you have red and white, and you got this other light color of green. You know, that's what you want to use. They say the red and the black is too hard on your brain. You can't think anymore if that happens. Well, in any event, in 1990, they went to the Checker Federation, and Chinook was there. They let Chinook come along, you know, and he played Tinsley, and it was head-to-head. There were 6 draws that took place in that game. Well, Schaefer invited Tinsley to come up to Canada, just play some fun game, just for fun. This was not a championship game or anything like that. And he did that, some friendly games, and Tinsley beat him. He beat him 4-2 with 33 draws. Well, that's not a friendly game to Schaefer, I'll tell you that. Not a friendly game at all, you know. And Schaefer also said that he could calculate that Tinsley can make a move and see what the consequences of the next 64 moves would have been in that circumstance. So this guy's got a checker brain, that's all you can say. Checker brain, and you know, and he used it. He used it. That's exactly right. Well, comes the World Championship, 1994. And Chinook is there and Tinsley is there. And the first six games they play each other are all draws. And then Tinsley gets this pain in his belly. He'd been having a pain in his belly for quite some time. It turns out they took him to the emergency room. It turns out he's got pancreatic cancer. And so he died very shortly after that. You know, and I think that Schaefer was not real thrilled about that. I'm hoping he was not hoping that just because what Tinsley had, but that he said, well, what am I going to do now? He's the best in the world. Nobody's going to believe me if I can't get Chinook great things to play against. So what they put a Chinook against Chinook. That's what they did. Put him like that until they got the best one. And I think that after that occurred, in July of 2007, they had conquered checkers. That means if you play the computer, if you play perfectly, you can get a draw, but you can never beat the computer. And that's after all these billions of things we're talking about in terms of stuff. And so you can imagine, no, can a human being do that? No, I mean, it's not possible. Chess has always been felt to be more a cerebral game than checkers. And IBM got into this with a thing called Deep Blue. They're going to try to make now do better than the champions can in chess. And I think that this test that was done in 1997, there was one that preceded that in 1996, and that one was won by Kasparov. He was the head of at that time, you know, but they fixed it up. You know, when they did that, they went to work and they fixed it up again. So they took him on again in six games in 1997, and he did get beat by Deep Blue. I think that it's saying here that humans can examine maybe 50 moves in a short period. Powerful computers can evaluate 200 million positions a second. I mean, who can think of that? But you know, who would have a chance against 200 million positions per second? I mean, that just blows your mind. So in any event, when this occurred, there was a documentary made of it, and Kasparov was really ticked off. He thought that some people from the outside had come in and helped. And I would say, well, why did they didn't need any help with that computer? How much more do you want? You could get 1,000 human brains, it ain't gonna help any. You know, but nonetheless, he said that he wanted to do it over again. You know, he's pouting pretty much. And he wants to do it over again. Well, IBM had gotten all kinds of positive things when they beat Kasparov. Their stock went up $10 a share. You know, they got all this free advertising, $500 million worth. No, they weren't going to take another chance to get beat. No way. They're not going to do that at all. I don't know if there's been any more chess stuff. You know, not that I care, but I don't know if there's been any. But again, it shows that checkers and chess, yeah, the machines can do better than the best we got. And that's Deep Blue over there on the right. Well, this is a card game. The only card game that would come to mind would be poker. And that's what we have here. And these are two guys that put together the ideal way to do poker. And I think that they worked on this for quite a period of time. And what they end up doing is basically getting some poker players who are very, very good and basically taking them all, and 13 of them. You can only get in if you had made at least $1 million playing poker. That's what the criteria was. These were professional people, professional poker players at least, you know, and they put the pluribus in there is what that was, and they started doing these things. They said it was going to be a little bit more difficult to do this than checkers and chess, because with checkers and chess, you always see what's there. There's nothing hidden. All the pieces are there. With poker, no, you got some cards turned over. You know, I got to wonder, you know, what are the odds of that? Should I go, or should I fold, or what should I do? You know, so that's what they did. And all they did was basically take five of these people, five of these 13, and all they did was play them. And they played them. The more they played them, the smarter Pluribus got, finally to a point where he could beat them all. You know, and I think that didn't require any more than a few weeks for that to happen, for him to beat them all. I mean, we're playing poker online in the past. I don't think I wouldn't do it anyway. I don't think I would do it if I was a poker player. How you know there's not a machine out there taking all your money away from you? But in any event, they said if a chip was $5, If that were the case, pluribus would win about $1,000 an hour. And he said, that's about the same as a professional would do against a novice. So in any event, yeah, poker, yeah, better than the players were. Now, what about transporter? All that stuff, it was kind of interesting, kind of get an idea about, you know, how good the brain is and how good the machine is, you know, but day to day, what do you do with that? Nothing. Doesn't have any significance to your day-to-day work. Well, this does. Autonomous autos. And this is becoming more and more, you know, something that's maybe a happening. I think that 1996, they had this car, had the driver in the car. He could control the accelerator and he could control the brake, but he didn't control the steering. And they went from one coach to the other, and they only had to change it just a little bit. About the whole time, steering across the United States, you know, the machine did it and got it done. So there are levels of this kind of stuff. Some people are getting a little help. There's some people that are doing these things, and you know, there's no help whatsoever. The machine is doing the entire thing. And the equipment that you need is only some very good sensors and some very good 3D maps. The 3D maps have to be within an inch of significance. That's what it has to be in order to try to do something like this and do it with any degree of safety. Now, there's a bunch of states across the United States that are interested in this. Florida is also, very much so. In June of this year, they made this agreement that if somebody gets their car to where it ought to be and they got data showing safety, you know, that you can come to Florida and put your unmanned cars out on the roads and let them run. You know, I'm not so sure that's going to be a good idea. I'm not so sure. It might be better to have it enclosed a little bit. I think they're going to act for a lot of problem. But nonetheless, the governor says, yes, come down. We want your money.
There's a testing ground.
What's that?
There's a testing ground here in Polk County.
In Polk County? Yeah. There you go. Well, GM was very interested in this, obviously, at the big car group. You know, and they said by the end of 2019, which is only a few months from now, that they would have a situation where you could have a car that's driven by their machine and no problem. But what problem occurred was in March of 2018, where a lady was hit by autonomous auto and killed. And I think that what happened, as best I can tell, she was kind of on the curb. You know, and you know, I don't know if the light was changing or what. She may have made a move up and then back and then back again. The car can't pick that stuff up. You can't look at somebody's face and say, you want to come across? Are you going to stay there? No, you can't get that information. And so as a result, things like that could occur, and that's what happened here. Of course, when that occurs that way, that certainly puts a damper, you know, on the whole thing. I think that the biggest roadblock certainly for this is safety. But I think that what we have to remember as well, one case like that gets big, big, big news. How many other people were killed that day besides that lady without being in an autonomous auto? You know, I think that, but the problem is you get one killing over here, they forget about the other 1,000 that occurred because, hey, that's just part of life. That's just the way it is. You get in the car, you take your chances. That's what it is. But I think that in any event, if you look at this, there's a lot of people saying, look, if we can get the safety issue better, if we can do that a lot better, we can reduce the amount of people we're killing each year on the highways, which is basically 40,000 people. 40,000 people per year. If you look here, when you've got the autonomous car, there's no alcohol, no drugs, no cell phones, and no going to sleep. You know, those are the biggest things, I think, that end up getting people killed. So if we could do something like that, I think that would be good. Obviously, it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of manpower to get that done. But nonetheless, I think it's certainly a way to go and certainly much more helpful than checkers. Here's the guy that's doing this. You know, I'm not sure if that foot he's got's on the steering wheel or not. It's hard. I mean, might not be trusting what's going on. Yeah, I'm reading this, but I don't do that stuff. But nonetheless, that's what this looks like. Some of them have a steering wheel and a brake in them. Some of them don't even have that in there. You know, and so in any event, some of them have passengers in the back. Some of them have people who can sit up in front like this guy. But nonetheless, it's a ways off, but not that far, I don't think. Autonomous trucks. Now, this is something I don't really think I care to be a part of. I mean, one truck is enough. You know what? You want some people out there unmanned with these huge, massive trucks? What they're talking about is doing truck caravans, having one person out there with a truck, and then having five or six back there that have no driver. And can you imagine going on an interstate and you got that conglomerate, you know, that's there? You know, I can't imagine it. You know, but nonetheless, you know, that's what's being talked about. How about planes? Now, if you don't know, most of the time you get in a plane, a computer's running the plane, not the pilots. You know, that's the case. But what are they talking about here? They're talking about having no pilots. Just the computer in the cockpit running the plane. No, I don't think so. Yes.
Why would they have to be in the plane? Couldn't they control it distantly?
I don't know. They might be able to do that later on. I'm not sure. Right now, they're talking about having being in the plane, but I don't know. Yes, Frank.
Because you add the additional risk of having to communicate with that device.
Sure. Well, I don't know that much about it. I do know that computers are used a lot now, and man is not, he's supervising pretty much to the most degree.
Yeah.
Service things, this is a military. I think that there's a guy back in 1920, a Czechoslovakian, who basically made the word robota, which basically means forced labor. That's what a robot is. You're making him do something, whether he likes it or not, you know, it's forced labor. And over a period of time in Japan, they had this robot that actually could do pretty well, could walk, could listen, could see. And I think that this is what it looks like. It's not too pretty, but nonetheless, that's what it is. Well, you know, when that occurred, then some people start thinking about, hey, maybe we could use this in wartime. Maybe we could do something like this. I mean, you know, if we lose five of these things in an hour, who cares? I mean, it's money, but no life has been lost. Nonetheless, I think that that along with drones and the pilotless planes and all this kind of stuff, you'd be doing war on your computer, you know, basically what's going to happen. I think that the other thing that occurred with robots, of course, is medical, surgical predominantly. And obviously robotic surgery, as I can tell, there's the man that knows more than I do about it, but it's been a very, very, very good thing. You know, it's helped a lot. Obviously, you still got a surgeon there who's manipulating the robot, but the robot can do some things that you can't do very well. And I think that's been great. I think that determining diagnoses, that's been a little bit of help. It's not as much help because you can't see somebody's countenance. You can't see how somebody's built. You can't see what's going on. You can't see the expression on their face and things like that. All those things have an impact upon, is this person really thinking really, really sick, or maybe a little bit sick, or maybe not sick at all, maybe just anxious or whatever it may be. You can't get that from a computer. You get that from your doctor. And I think that this other thing about it, the EMR, I think that's been a disaster as far as I'm concerned. The EMR was something that was developed, electronic medical record, something that was developed to help with billing. That's what it was developed for. And they didn't use it for billing as much. They used it for doctors to use in their office. And it's widespread, you know. And what it has done, in my experience, is taken away a lot of the interaction with patients. And it's also put doctors in a situation where they're spending much more time on their computer than they are reading up to what the most recent information is in the scientific journals, because there's not enough time to do all that. Plus, it's extraordinarily expensive. You know, that's what happens. But I don't see it going away. I think that it was one of the reasons I went away, I'll tell you that. I was getting sick of working all the time and working all the time and working all the time, and that's what it took. You know, in addition, there were some doctors, not the ones that I think are good doctors, but there were some doctors, you know, who didn't even pay attention to the patient, just pay attention to the computer. The patient would come in, they may say a few niceties, you know, they bring their chart up, they think that's this, I see, give me your slips for your sugars, I see, I'll put those in there. You're done, okay, I'll see you later. You know, that's what's happened. And so, again, I think it's not a good thing, but nonetheless, I don't see it going away. I'm certainly glad I'm not involved with it anymore. Risk involved, obviously, that's what we are concerned about. And in addition, about insurance, you know, if somebody is in an artificial or autonomous auto and there's an accident, you know, well, whose fault is it? You know, was the program wrong? Was the hard drive wrong? You know, who is it? You know, and who's the insurance? Where do they get in with this? They blame it on the companies that built the things that was faulty, and you didn't have insurance with our company. I don't know. It's certainly a possibility in any event of a difficulty, I think. Unemployment, I think, is something that's a very great concern. About 40% of our employment across the country is vulnerable and could be adversely affected. And the Industrial Revolution, as you remember reading in history, you know, that sort of thing was there too. I don't think it's as big a threat as what this is, but nonetheless, it's going to take a long time. You say, well, people just have to get adjusted to the new world. That's what they got to do. Well, yes, but that's not going to be easy and not going to be fast. You know, and so as a result, that is a real consideration, I think. Now, why am I here today? I had a good time. That's why I'm here today. But on the other hand, there are some people who are now doing some things that are definitely anti-Christian, you know, and I'm just going to give you a little tidbit about it. I think that we were talking about AI, artificial in the weak sense, but there's a stronger sense. The stronger sense is I'm as good as a human being. My brain is as good as yours is. You know, we know that that's not the case at this point in time, but some people are out there thinking that it could be the case at some point in time, that sooner or later that could happen, where that robot you're doing is not just giving you some food, he's understanding why he's giving you some food, because you're hungry. And if your drink goes down, you might want some more, so you give some more. Otherwise, you just take the direction, but you don't have any sense about why am I doing this, or what shouldn't I do, or could I do something else that'd be even better? No, none of that is there. You know, so it's not at all. This strong AI is totally different, I think, than the weaker AI. I think that what people have said is that, look, man has gotten his intelligence over years, as I mentioned, you know, way back there in the Stone Age days, back up to a pocket computer. Yeah, but it took a long time to get that sort of done. Well, that's not the case necessarily with robots. You can get those up and running and get a lot of information done with them very easily. I think, in addition, I think that there are some people, you know, who are least important in the world, very well known in the world, who believe that if we continue to pursue to try to get a strong AI, that that's going to have a detrimental effect on humanity. Now, those four, Stephen Hawking, of course, he's not with us anymore, but Elon Musk, Steve Wozniak, and Bill Gates, the only one of the three that I know is a Christian is Bill Gates, you know, and I think that the others, I don't know what their concern is in terms of humans, but Bill Gates' concern is human beings are in the image of God and we don't want them all killed. You know, that's pretty much what's happening. But again, these are pretty smart guys in one sense, and they're saying that I think there's really potential for this happening. So I think when you look at a robot compared to a human, robot's stronger, smarter, doesn't get disease, doesn't need rest, doesn't have a lifespan as long as you keep putting the parts in. We don't have those kinds of things. And so I think that what has occurred is this way of the future. This is a group that's gotten together. Their leader is Anthony Lewandowski. He's a millionaire out in Silicon Valley. And basically, he's been involved with autonomous autos now for quite a while. He initially, I think, was with Uber, and then he went to Google. But he's in part of this sort of milieu that's out there, and again, he's basically saying we're going to transition this slowly, but we are going to transition. Robots are going to run the world at some point in time. Now, this is a guy that made a movie, something like that. This is the guy back in 1920, I think, made the movie. He looks kind of, you know, nasty-like, at least to me, in turn, that'd be a good guy to make a horror flick, you know, that somebody like that. But in any, what happens in this movie is that there's a rebellion of the robots. They've had it. We're tired of taking your directions all the time. You know, we're not getting paid for any of this, you know, and so as a result, they come and grab the humans, and they kill all the humans and take over the world. And so that's what the movie was. I never saw that movie, but I did see this one. How many saw that one? 2001 Space Odyssey? I remember seeing that very well. Stanley Kubrick doing this. Here there are two people in a space plane, and they're up in space, and there's a computer that's running the thing called HAL. HAL 9000, I think. And so what happens was a mistake is made. And Hal made the mistake as far as those guys were concerned. So they said, we got to get rid of Hal and do this on our own because we can't trust Hal. And so Hal hears this, you know. And so one of the guys, as he's getting close to where the door is in the plane, pushes the button and pushes him out. And he's done for. The other guy, has seen what happened, knows it's between him and Hal, you know, and they start to fight in that regard. And he starts to take Hal down one by one and disassemble him altogether. And you hear Hal crying, you know, because he's going to die, you know. And that's what this sort of thing is like in terms of these robots having this kind of a situation. And I think this is Michelangelo, obviously, but the people who are in this have adopted this. Basically, God made man in his image, but God now is favoring robots. You know, and so that's what the situation has been. Now, I think that obviously we don't believe in any of that mess. There's not any sense to it whatsoever. I think it's just not, shouldn't do it. In any event, I think, I didn't say it. But I was thinking it. So anyhow, we got a commission up here now, a commission already in April that basically is saying, you know, this is all baloney, don't believe in any of it, anything like that. I think that this is kind of interesting because just the last couple of days, the head of the guy, the head of the, Anthony Levinowski, the head of that group, he's been charged with giving away secrets. You know, that he went from, as he went from one company to the other, he took all their secrets and gave them to this company, and now he's facing jail. So maybe that's his punishment for such a ridiculous thing that he was trying to bring forth. Well, that's really all I have. If anybody has any questions, I probably can't answer them, but yeah.
Has anybody tried to put personality or define personality and put it in a computer?
Right.
Define emotions.
Correct.
In other words, try and make a Hal.
Yes. Well, that's all part of the high level AI, and whether anybody's ever going to be able to do that or not, I have my doubts. I doubt it. You know, but nonetheless, that's what they would like. They would like a robot that's smart, thinks ahead, knows what you ought to be doing and not doing, is caring. You know, all those things. You know, but I just can't see it happening. Yes.
Do you know who commissioned that study that was just recently completed?
It.
Do you have in your last?
I talk? Did have it. I can't remember. It was, I think, the Methodists, I think. But they did do it, and it's available online. You can get it. I read it. Yeah, it's very good. But it's just remarkable to me that you would feel a necessity of doing that. I mean, This to me is a bunch of baloney, and I don't think it's a kind of a thing that you necessarily have to respond to, but they did respond. Yes, Richard.
When I'm reading some of this stuff over the years, I've often thought if we progress, or when we progress to the point where you could take the human brain and put it inside a mechanical body, you know, like Ghost in the Shell kind of stuff, is the brain the seat of the soul, and would you be transferring an entire person into that if you transferred the brain?
Well, number one, I don't think you can.
Transfer an elder also, please.
I don't think you can transfer a brain any more than you can take these people and freeze them, cut their heads off, and then hope someday they're going to put their head back on. The brain's going to be healthy. I mean, I just don't see that happening. The brain is so complex, and God made it that way. And I don't think we're going to be in a position where that's ever going to happen.
But if you could. Well, I mean, if you consider the brain is the seat of thinking and then all the instructions for all the rest of the body come from there, if you could take that.
Is your soul in your brain?
Do what?
Is your soul in your brain?
Yeah, if you could take that control unit and put it in an artificial body, would that also contain? That's going to be what they're.
Well, that's what you got with a robot. This group, you know, has been talking about, well, what we think is going to happen is since God's going to shift from humans to robots, he's going to give robots a soul, and he'll give them eternal life, and he'll give them, you know, Christ's blood. Yeah, he's going to do all that for the robots. That's what they're thinking, you know, at that point in time. Yes, sir.
I couldn't tell from the lecture. Did you believe that portion, or did you think that that was just a load of...
I thought that was clear. No, I don't believe any of it at all. It's ridiculous. It's stupid. Well, gosh, we got done early, so have a good time. Thanks for coming. And let me just say a little prayer for us. Father, we thank you that you love us. We thank you that we're made in your image. And Father, we thank you that we have your word. And so we don't have to worry about crazy people like this and not feel like that we're being overly threatened when we know that you are our fortress. We pray, Father, that you'll be with us during the morning hour, and that the sermon will strike our hearts. In Christ's name, amen.